From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there may be a big step forward in the fight against COVID-19. A team of researchers from the University of Oxford in England says they've discovered the first drug that reduces deaths by a third in the sickest of COVID patients. Now, Matt Herper has been reporting on this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Matt, we know the drug is already in the market. It's a steroid. What is it? What does it do?
This is actually a pretty old drug called dexamethasone, and the use here is in patients who are in the hospital, are on oxygen or on ventilators. And it didn't do anything in people who didn't meet those criteria. But in that situation, there's a lot of inflammation going on because of the disease in the lungs. It appears, based on the limited information we have, that this really worked very well in this study.
In not just reducing the inflammation, but saving lives. We know that remdesivir has been successful in shortening infections, but this is about a claim of saving lives. Now, we want to say, as you write, Atul Gawande, the public health researcher, tweeted out, after all the retractions and walkbacks, it's unacceptable to tout study results by press release without releasing the paper. This paper from Oxford has not been released or peer-reviewed. This is just a press release. And he might be referring to hydroxychloroquine, which also reduced inflammation and, you know, arthritis, but hasn't proven effective against COVID-19. So why do researchers say this is? Like, what is the critical thing? Is it just how much it reduces inflammation?
There are a lot of drugs that reduce inflammation. But the question is, when you put it into a clinical trial and you randomly assign people to get the drug or control, and that's very important. The studies that were retracted were observational studies where you weren't assigning people at random. You were looking at what happened when you decide to give people drugs. That's much less reliable. So this study is 11,500 patients from 175 hospitals in the United Kingdom, and they were given either regular care or one of several different drugs. One of them was hydroxychloroquine, which this same study said showed no benefit. Another was dexamethasone. Now, that said, we have none of the details. We have two lines on this, essentially, that we're all excited about and that we're pretty sure we can trust. But obviously, doctors would like to have the whole six-page journal article to look at what happened in all the subgroups and what are the side effects. And we don't know any of that.
Yeah. Well, we do know, you started to say, the number of people in the study. And we know that it randomly assigned a couple thousand of them this dexamethasone once a day. Mm-hmm. About 4,000 others did not have it. And those who did have it, there, as the report concluded, there were a third fewer deaths. Now, you go on to say that this means that when you reduce a death rate, for instance, of someone, you know, on a ventilator by 35%, that means doctors have to treat 8 ventilator patients in order to have that one success. It's not everybody survived.
Right. Although I have to say, in years of covering clinical trials, that's one of the best number needed to treats I've ever seen. That's a really good number.
Right. And we have no idea what the side effects might be or the downside might be, because, again, this is in such early stages. Well, what are the next steps now that it's been used in the UK? Will it be used in the US?
So I would expect that once these results are out, that this would be broadly used. The UK is saying, you know, same day they said that they would start using it in hospitalized patients.
Yeah. And again, trying to get at why it would be effective for the most sick, you know, to save lives, but not for people who aren't that sick yet. You write about the way this particular virus attacks the lungs, acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. That might have something to do with it?
Yes. So there's, I mean, this is true in a lot of illnesses, that there's kind of the infection starts going, and early on you want to treat the infection. In a lot of these situations, what doctors actually want to do with these very sick patients is turn the immune system down, that it's actually the immune system that's doing some of the damage. And so that's what all of these anti-inflammatory drugs that have been in trials for COVID-19 were expected to do. This is a really big benefit. This really is substantial.
Well, fingers crossed. Matt Harper with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you have had a virtual doctor's appointment in the last few months instead of an in-person one, you know things have changed in the world of healthcare because of the pandemic. The telehealth boom, though, is just one of those things. For more, we're joined by Kaiser Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with telehealth. Is it here to stay even once we're all vaccinated and comfortable going back into the doctor's office in person?
Well, it certainly looks like it. One expert told me that the genie is not going back into the bottle. Telehealth has really taken off in the past couple of months as so many physical offices were forced to close. And for a lot of medical visits, it's more convenient for both patients and practitioners. The big question, of course, is how much those visits are eventually going to cost and who's going to pay for it. For now, Medicare and most health insurers are paying close to what they pay for regular office visits, but there's the possibility of creating a whole new spending stream if visits are reimbursed too generously. Patients could end up on the hook for some of that. On the other hand, if reimbursement is too low, it will be hard for those who really need it most to get it, like seniors who have trouble getting to doctors' offices or people in rural areas who have trouble getting to doctors in general. So I think it's safe to say telehealth is here to stay, but we don't really know at what level.
Hmm. And a lot of people have been skipping or delaying their primary care doctor visits because of the pandemic. Now, the American Academy of Family Physicians reports that 40% of primary care physician offices have laid off or furloughed staff since March. Julie, is primary care as we know it going to survive the pandemic?
A lot of policy experts are really worried about what's going to happen to primary care in general, primary care doctors in particular. Many have had to close their doors and lay off their staff. And even now that a lot of them can reopen, they still have to get that personal protective equipment. And it's not clear how willing patients are to come back yet. Even those doctors who didn't physically close their doors saw huge drop-offs in patients as they avoided medical locations for fear of catching the virus. One really big concern is that this will force a lot of those doctors to sell their practices to hospitals, creating still more consolidation in the healthcare industry that tends to drive spending even higher.
You know, some people might be surprised that hospitals are in such trouble in the midst of a pandemic where hospitals are so essential, but they really are. They're struggling, especially rural hospitals. Do you think that there's going to be a lasting change in the way that hospitals operate and manage their budgets after this?
I think it's important to remember that hospitals are really diverse. Some are these giant facilities with equally giant endowments, and as you mentioned, some are rural facilities that may only have a handful of beds. Congress provided $100 billion back in March that mostly went to hospitals that serve Medicare patients, which is most of them. But that money didn't really go out based on hospital need. So the hospitals that were struggling are still struggling. And now many have the added problems of keeping expensive units available for COVID patients, paying more for basic supplies, not just PPE, but other supplies, because the supply chain has been disrupted. And in many places, hospitals are still not open for the elective procedures, things like hip and knee replacement and cardiac care, which is where they get a lot of their revenue. So it depends on the hospital. But yes, hospitals in general are going to have to kind of reexamine how they do business.
Well, we've been talking to doctors who are fearing a wave of people coming in the months ahead to deal with procedures that they put off before. So we'll see what happens with that. What about health insurance, Julie? We've been talking about it for years, especially with Obamacare and then the attacks on Obamacare. Do you see any movement in this moment when so many people might be losing their jobs and their health insurance in the middle of this pandemic towards something like Medicare for All or expanded Medicare or anything like that?
Well, first of all, health insurance companies themselves are doing just fine through all of this. Remember that huge drop-off in routine and elective care? That's all stuff that insurance companies aren't having to reimburse for at the moment. So even the money that they're paying for COVID patients is way less than the care that's going undelivered now. But I'm waiting to see if the public broadly changes its mind about the idea that so many fellow Americans don't have any insurance coverage or have coverage that they can't afford to use because they have multi-$1,000 deductibles. Because those people who can't use a healthcare system can be a threat to everyone else when it comes to contagious disease. And I think that sort of point is coming home to a lot of people, maybe for the first time. Could this shake up the political debate about health insurance? Absolutely. Will it? Not clear yet.
One more thing I want to ask you about is the drug industry. There have been calls from Congress, from the president, to bring more drug manufacturing to America. We've discovered in this pandemic how much of the at least components of our drugs are made in China, for example. Is there going to be change on that front, bringing more back to the U.S.?
Well, there's already a big push, both in the administration and in Congress, to do something about the fact that so much of our drug supply, as you mentioned, it's in some cases it's the drugs themselves. In some cases, it's the ingredients that go into drugs that might be made in the United States. So much of that has moved overseas. It's moved around the world. It's not just China. But one of the things that we saw early in this pandemic is that countries very quickly closed up their borders and all of this, you know, global supply chain ground to a halt. And if you're in a pandemic and you need drugs, it's not a good thing when your drugs are not made in your country and you can't get them anymore.
That is Kaiser Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner. Julie, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Throughout America's history, small choices have compounded into big inequalities. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. How Injustice Gets Ingrained. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen now.
Part of the upset over President Trump's planned political rally Saturday in Tulsa is that the city is the sacred site of an event 99 years ago when a white mob massacred hundreds of blacks and burned down Tulsa's thriving so-called Black Wall Street. Last year, we spoke to Brenda Alford. Her grandparents lived through the massacre after they ran for their lives.
My grandparents went to one of the parks that was further out and stayed there until they felt like it was okay to come back, only to find their homes and their businesses looted and burned to the ground.
Just like that, a generation of wealth wiped out. And that's not the only time. Elsewhere in the program, we talked about today's huge black-white wealth gap. Let's hear more now about the systemic economic racism that led to that. With William Darity, professor of economics and African-American studies at Duke. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And start where you say this racial divide starts. Of course, there was slavery. In its aftermath, former slaves after the Civil War were promised 40 acres of land and a mule. That did not happen.
No, that did not happen. Actually, the process of delivery of the land grants was undertaken, but it was reversed. When General Sherman reached Savannah, Georgia, at the end of his march through the state, he met with a group of black leaders, primarily composed of ministers. And Sherman asked them, what did they want to have happen? And their response was, give us land to farm and leave us alone. Mm-hmm. And so Sherman issued General Orders Number 15, which provided a swath of land stretching from South Carolina to northern Florida that was supposed to be allotted to the formerly enslaved. But if you look at the full range of land that was supposed to be assigned to the formerly enslaved, there was only a very small share of the total that was actually distributed. And by the end of the year, President Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, reversed the policy that had been embedded in Sherman's special order and had the land that had been allocated up to that point restored to the former slaveholders. And this happens at the same time that the Homestead Acts are being mobilized to provide 160 acres lots to many white Americans in the western part of the United States in territories that had been appropriated from the native population, while the formerly enslaved received no form of restitution. And I would argue that that's the beginning of the contemporary racial wealth gap in the United States. But to compound that, you had a situation for a period of about 80 years in which an array of white massacres that took place in the United States, both North and South, destroyed black lives, destroyed black property, and in many instances resulted in the appropriation of black property by white Americans who engaged in mob violence.
I'm going to tick through some of them. We mentioned Tulsa. But before that, 1912, Forsyth County, Georgia, white mobs drove out an estimated 1,000 or so black residents. Author Patrick Phillips calls this racial cleansing. Back further, 1873, Colfax, Louisiana, about 150 black men murdered for trying to gather at a courthouse. 1906, Atlanta massacre. Whites there, again, threatened by black success stories, a white mob murderously attacking the community. The Elaine, Arkansas massacre, 1919, black sharecroppers wanted to form a union. Enraging whites who slaughtered black men, women, and children.
Yeah, 1919 was what was described as the Red Summer, where there were upwards of 36 of these massacres that took place north and south. Not only does it include Elaine, Arkansas, but it also includes northern cities like Chicago, where there was a major, highly destructive riot that took place.
Well, most of these attacks were launched under the false claim that a black man had dared to touch or look at or assault a white woman. Hence, by the way, the uproar over Amy Cooper's threat to a bird watcher in Central Park to say an African-American man was assaulting her, which he wasn't. I mean, that had historic echoes for so many. But it does seem like that was always cover for what these were really about, which was stopping black economic progress.
Yeah, but you know, there are also some interesting exceptions to that pattern. The Chicago case was precipitated by a 17-year-old black man swimming across this imaginary line that was functioning as a boundary in Lake Michigan between where blacks could swim and where whites could swim. And he was stoned to death by whites when black folks on the shore attempted to retaliate for his execution. That's when the white mobs were enraged, and they destroyed large portions of the black community, burning down and shattering homes that I think probably amount to a value of anywhere between $1.5 billion to $3 billion in current currency.
Imagine if families had those homes for several generations or were able to sell those homes and the wealth that accrues from that. But all of that gets stopped in all of these events. Another thing that happened post-Civil War, Reconstruction, there was like a whole new system of enslavement set up through this phony fee system, whereas if blacks could not pay certain fees, they were in effect re-enslaved and sent to work in factories that were in on this deal. They were getting these free workers.
Yeah, and this is embodied in a series of laws that we now refer to as the Black Codes. These laws essentially controlled black family life, black mobility, and they were designed in such a way that not only did they determine which occupations blacks could be channeled into, but they also prevented black workers from leaving jobs unless it was at the discretion of the white employer. It was a form of re-enslavement.
Fast forward, redlining in the 1930s, the Federal Housing Administration would not insure mortgages in black neighborhoods. So there's not the mobility that's needed for economic progress. Talk about some of the other forces. I mean, I understood once that the GI Bill that helped my father and so many buy a home, that returning black veterans didn't get that.
That's correct. Certainly, they didn't get it to the same extent that returning white veterans did. But I think that this process of constraining black capacity to attain home ownership begins in part with the institution of restrictive covenants. So restrictive covenants essentially said certain property, certain home properties could not be sold to black folks. When restrictive covenants are declared illegal, that process is supplanted by redlining. The designation of certain neighborhoods as being unworthy of credit access. And then, as you mentioned, you have the introduction of the GI Bill in the aftermath of World War II. Southern white legislators in Congress insisted that the bill be designed in such a way that it would be administered locally. And local administration of the bill meant that local whites could control who would get the resources among veterans from the bill. So the political scientist Ira Katznelson demonstrates in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White, that if we looked at the state of Mississippi, there were only two returning black veterans who received the benefits of the GI Bill for the purposes of buying a home. So you had racially discriminatory application of the GI Bill, which is another way in which you separated the access and opportunity to upward mobility on the part of blacks and whites.
It's really pretty stunning. Roadblocks everywhere. Someone sticking their foot out to trip you economically everywhere. And your research shows that black homes now, with a head earner who's a college grad, have less wealth on average than white homes led by high school dropouts, primarily because there's been no accrued wealth. And your study on the color of wealth in Boston was part of a big Boston Globe. They used your research as part of a project. It showed that black homes had, on average, total life savings, $8, as opposed to a little over $250,000 for white families. And again, that's attributed to, you know, not having the value of a home, or, you know, not having the accrued wealth of generations behind it. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's staggering, and it's devastating. It would be a very different world, I think, had initially the formerly enslaved actually received at least the 40 acres. If 40 acres had been distributed to all of the newly emancipated blacks, we're talking about an allocation of 40 million acres of land. So that didn't happen, but neither did Sherman's more abbreviated allocation of 5.3 million acres. So the capacity to transfer resources across generations was deeply stunted for black Americans.
William Darity, professor of public policy and African American studies and economics, and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
He joined us by Skype. And by the way, for the reasons Professor Darity just outlined, he is a staunch supporter of reparations. His new book makes that case. It sounds terrific. I will link you at herenow.org.
Airlines are starting to enforce tougher rules during the coronavirus pandemic. There are new penalties for passengers who refuse to wear masks. And now some airlines are no longer serving alcohol on flights. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this is kind of a big change. Why are some airlines suspending alcohol service?
Yeah, you've heard of dry counties, but now dry airlines, at least in big parts of their networks, an airline like Delta, not serving any alcohol within the Americas. So they'll still serve you on a flight, let's say, to Europe and Asia. Of course, not many people traveling abroad these days. American Airlines mostly doing the same thing, although it will serve in first class, just not in economy.
But is it because they don't want people to get kind of too drunk and rowdy? Or is it because they don't want people taking their masks off for long enough to have an alcoholic drink?
Yeah, more the latter. I mean, look, no question, an ancillary benefit is that if we think about some of the times we hear about bad things happening on airplanes, very often they have something to do with alcohol, although the vast majority of people, I know certainly I've had plenty of drinks on flights and I've never gotten in a fight, and that's true of most people, but it's mainly about, right, not having a reason to take off a mask, and for that matter, not having a reason to have to get up and go to the bathroom, because they're just trying to keep people in one place. So if somebody's drinking a lot of beer, that's just more interaction with more people on the flight, more touching other surfaces and that sort of thing. Also more interaction with flight attendants. Right now they're trying to keep all that to a minimum.
Now, when it comes to masks, a lot of airlines have already been requiring passengers to wear masks, but now some are saying they will ban people from future flights if they don't comply.
Yeah, in that regard, United and Delta are two who have both said some form of that. Airlines trying to get this right with some combination of the carrot and the stick. Allegiant is the one among notable U.S. airlines that's still relying much more on the carrot. It's not even requiring masks, even though it strongly encourages them. Other airlines have kind of gone back and forth between telling their people, look, yeah, tell them it's required, but don't get in a fight. But now you have these airlines dangling that, you know, whether they will actually ban somebody for flying an airline forever, we'll have to see. But they are at least threatening that. Clearly, most people at this point are wearing masks, but we all know the danger is in the person not wearing a mask, a danger to ourselves if that person happens to have COVID-19. Mm-hmm.
So let me just finally ask you the question I ask you every time we talk, which is, what is the state of air travel right now? What's the state of their finances, too?
Yeah, at this minute, we look up in the sky, and if I could see everything going on up there, something like 35% of the domestic seats that would have been flying, let's say that were flying a year ago this week, are flying right now. That's well off the lows, but well, obviously, do the math, 65% away from the highs. Sometime next month is when they'll hit 50%, all that according to Cirium's schedule data. As far as their finances, look, bigger macro questions, right? An upside surprise would be a vaccine in production sooner than anybody thinks. On the other hand, a bad second wave in the fall could make things worse. Right now, these U.S. airlines, emphasis on that, all seem to be sustainable, but they're going to be smaller. There are going to be job losses at most of them come October.
That is Here Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Joining us today is Anthony Valadez, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Anthony, great to have you back.
Jeremy, it's always great to hang with you and talk music, brother.
Tell us what you had in mind with these picks, Anthony. Any theme going on here?
Actually, you know what, Jeremy? There's really no theme, but looking back, I mean, I'm looking at the playlist and there's songs of the Latin diaspora, and that definitely was not intentional. These are just songs I love.
All right, well, let's get to some of them. This is the Chilean rapper Ana Tiju with Antifa Dance. Somos los choros, los flights y los caras de nana, los caras de nada. Somos los patis pelados, los comas, los rotos, los chulos y quemados. Somos los cholos morenos, los chicos sin pelo, la lengua ya está. Somos morenos y qué bueno, no tenemos miedo, no tenemos nada, nada, nada. Para mí que tu izquierda siempre fue derecha, me da la sospecha que tú te aprovechas. Tú nada cosechas ni prende la mecha, ni ahí con tu cuera no te prendo vela. Baja y escucha, escucha la lucha, descafeinado, tremenda trucha. Ya no hay excusa para ser blanducha, no se me confunda, buena capucha. Now, as I said, this is called Antifa Dance. We've been hearing about Antifa in this country. But in the case of Ana Tiju, she's talking about some of the issues going on in Chile.
That's correct. I mean, basically, what she's speaking about coincides with what's happening in America, but also in her home country of Chile. Her parents were living in political exile in France during the Pinochet dictatorship during the 70s and 80s. And she's just heavily involved with women's rights and the protection of indigenous people and people of color across the world. And you hear a lot of that in her work. And for folks who don't know, she's been rapping since the 90s. She was in a group called Maguisa. And then she broke out and has kind of been evolving stylistically, sonically, and visually. And she's been hailed by Tom York of Radiohead, who said her record 1977 should be listened to by just about everybody.
Okay, well, the next one you have brought us is by Clubs. This is called Pronto. This Latin vibe today, Anthony. And by the way, this one is from Monterrey, Mexico, right?
That's correct. And what I love about this song is that it reminds me of LA, and it sounds very poolside-ish. Sounds like Tori Moi, but they say, they have this great quote, they don't want to be the Hispanic version of your favorite band. So I really dig that. And also being out of Monterrey, which is known for the kidnappings and there's a lot of drug violence, so it was hard for these guys to actually play out and develop a local fan base. So I'm glad the internet's around and these guys are definitely sharing their music and kind of putting Monterrey music on the map.
Well, and what do you think they mean by that, that they don't want to be the Hispanic version of your favorite band?
Well, I think traditionally for a lot of Latinos, you know, we're happy to have a Latin alternative spotlight. But at the same time, we don't want to be boxed in. We want to be just music. Mm-hmm. When you talk about Coldplay, you don't call them British rock or whatever. It's, you know, it's Coldplay. And I think the same can be said with what they're saying. And also, you know, there's nothing worse than being called the Latino Joy Division. You know, it's like these guys are clubs.
All right. Well, the next one you brought us is Junior Mesa. This is called Far Out. Very soulful sound from Junior Mesa.
Yeah, and he's only 20 years old. He's a multi-instrumentalist out of Bakersfield, California. And what I love about him is when something moves you sonically and you tell your friends about it and they know about it, and you're like, wait, how do you know about this? And there's definitely this really positive buzz. And what I love about him is that he channels, you know, he's a fan, admittedly, of Sly and the Family Stone, Ella Fitzgerald, Wes Montgomery. And I love that these kids are channeling that spirit and implementing it into these new sounds. So it's amazing.
How do you find all these 20-year-olds? Or, like, I feel like we've had 18-year-olds from you before on the DJ sessions.
Well, I mean, I'm very active on blogs. I love the internet, but I love, you know, talking to kids. I talk to these young bands, and I'm like, who are you listening to? And they hit me to some of the coolest stuff, and so I'm always learning. It's fun. Yeah, I'm eternally 18.
Good. Well, the next one that you have brought us is Sumo Hair. This is Palo de Mango. Flavor there with the steel drum, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm so glad you used that word tropical. So Sumo Hair was born in Mexico, now based in LA, and he's in a band called Reina Tropical, which incorporates vocals, drum loops, reggaeton samples, and guitars. And I found out about this kid. I saw him live and I explored, checked him out, and found his Bandcamp page. And I found all his work, and he does these really cool remixes of cumbia and like hip hop and funk and soul. And that's a lot of what I do in LA when we DJ. There's a lot of that in LA parties, is this inclusion of all these different sounds. But Sumo Hair manages to take it one step further and really create something new and something that's tropical, as you mentioned, but also just different and fresh. And I love it. And a side note, he's also a celebrated hairstylist who studied in New York at Vidal Sassoon.
Which is obviously something to do with how he got the name Sumo Hair, I guess.
Bingo.
Let's get to the next one. This is the Altons. This is When You Go, That's When You'll Know. Anthony, this is taking me back to my LA days, like listening to your show, driving down like Melrose and just getting lost in the music like this.
Good. That was the whole point. I'm glad you connected those dots. And this is there's something beautiful happening in music today where it's the revitalization of Chicano doo-wop. You know, growing up in LA, especially like around gang culture. A lot of the gang members, for some weird reason, I never understood this, but you know, they were warriors during the day, but they were lovers at night. And they would, I remember hearing, you know, oldies and the Art LeBeau show and songs like I'm Your Puppet. And so 30 years later, I'm watching these 18-year-old kids recreating this sound, and even as going as far as recreating the sonic aesthetics with authentic studio gear from 30 years ago. And you know, you're starting to hear more of a falsetto, more passion and more love. And the Altons definitely embrace that. And another group that's being championed now is Chicano Batman, that has these same aesthetics, and I love it.
You know, the original DJ that I got obsessed with as a kid in the middle of Illinois was on an oldies station. So I was listening to songs of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and probably if you played just about any one of them, I could sing all of the lyrics to it. I haven't tested myself on that in a while, but anybody who's influenced by that music, I say all for it. Anthony Valadez, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Thanks as always.
Jeremy, we love you, but please don't ever utilize that falsetto in front of me, please.
Okay, we'll do. And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Lots going on today. Senate Republicans announced their proposal for police reform. And very soon, Georgia's Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard is expected to announce whether two Atlanta officers will face criminal charges in the death of Rayshard Brooks, and if so, which charges. Brooks was shot and killed in a Wendy's parking lot after officers found him asleep in his car. He'd been drinking, and what was initially a calm interaction with the officers became a scuffle. Brooks was running away with an officer's taser when he was shot. Joining us now, the president of Georgia's NAACP, James Woodall. And James, I imagine there's heightened anticipation as you wait for possible charges.
We're not only just waiting for charges, but we're waiting for systematic reforms so that we can ensure that this doesn't happen again. You know, though there is a possibility of a criminal prosecution for accountability in this murder, we do believe that this is not really the conclusion that we're waiting for. We need change. We need it urgently.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you use the word murder. We'll wait to see if officials have the same conclusion. Right now, calling it a killing. But you talk about reform. And let's talk about some of the suggestions. Yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order calling for a ban on police chokeholds unless the life of an officer is at stake. Today, the Senate Republican proposal included incentives for police departments to ban chokeholds. Now, many have wanted an outright ban, no caveats. But it's been a surprise to many that Republicans would even call for these forms of bans on chokeholds. So do you see this as a step forward, that the recent videos and protests have caused a shift, or, you know, maybe wanting more?
I think this is not a step forward. And in fact, I think it's very, very telling of where we are as a country, where its leadership is refusing to actually listen to those individuals who are in the communities every single day, the individuals who are protesting, literally tear gassed every single day, that they are demanding systematic changes in the level of piecemeal solutions that have been proposed both by the president in his executive orders, which honestly did nothing, and then the Senate Republicans and the members of Congress. It's unacceptable. Every single day we have people die.
Well, yesterday your group tweeted out that these executive orders of the Trump administration would not have saved the lives of Ahmaud Arbery or Rayshard Brooks. Arbery, of course, stalked and shot by a former officer and his son while Arbery was out jogging. In that case, Gregory and Travis McMichaels have been charged with Arbery's murder. So was the man who filmed the incident. And Rayshard Brooks was killed by an officer as Brooks ran away. So we're waiting to see if there's a charge there, meaning there are laws. But it sounds like you're talking about something way beyond laws.
That's right. In this country, we have a precedence where the dehumanization of people, of human beings, have been promulgated by state code. And in the state of Georgia, we have laws on the books that were unjustifiably used to really endorse what happened in February in the case of Ahmaud Arbery. If it was not for the persistence of Ahmaud's mother, we would not be having a conversation about the two murderers actually being put to trial. Instead, we'd be talking about yet another young person whose life was unjustifiably taken. And because of the statute, therefore, there would be no accountability. And so this is continuing to happen. But we have a lot of work to do if we actually want to save lives. Now, if we just simply want to say we did something to respond to another emotional moment, then what we're going to see is what the president and Congress has done. But if we actually want to save people's lives, only way that we are able to do that is if people who are on the ground are all together with the lawmakers, with those who have businesses, with those who are in the civil rights community, where we all collectively come together and actually make the world that we know we deserve. That's not happening. Right now, you have people in very high places, and they are so out of touch with what the people actually are asking for.
Well, you're waiting for this huge seismic change, but in the meantime, there is symbolism, and Republicans are also calling in their proposal for making lynching a hate crime, which astonishing that it's not. And we know that Rand Paul recently stood in the way of that legislation in Congress. It sounds like Republicans are walking over him at this point. You and your state, Georgia lawmakers were returning this week for a new session, and there are renewed calls for them to reconsider HB 426, which would impose harsher sentences to crimes motivated by racial bias. The House passed it last year. Now it's in the Senate. Would that be a step?
No, it would not be. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why is because, again, what we have seen in this, even the lieutenant governor put out a new version or a new bill regarding hate crimes. They are prioritizing neo-Nazis and members of the Klan over actual people. Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to when you have a culture that really allows for this kind of promulgation of policy that is disconnected from reality, then you're going to have more murder. And so the blood of Black people who are literally dead in the streets are now not only on the hands of murderers, but on the hands of policymakers on the local, state, and federal level.
James Woodall, president of Georgia's NAACP. James, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And again, we're awaiting charges in the police shooting death of Rayshard Brooks at a Wendy's. That's expected in about an hour. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.